All those years ago, one of the greatest musical stars of the 20th century, Dusty Springfield, the woman who was born Mary Isabel Catherine Bernadette O'Brien to an Irish mother, was at the very epicentre of 1960s music. She introduced singers like Martha and the Vandellas, Stevie Wonder and the Supremes to audiences who had never heard the sound of Motown even. And she was the first artist to be deported from apartheid South Africa in 1964 for refusing to play to segregated audiences. One of the greatest British female singers of all time we're talking about here. Echoes of Dusty can still be clearly heard in the work of Amy Winehouse and Adele and countless other female singers. After attaining great heights in the 60s, Dusty Springfield's life spiralled out of control in the 1970s. She battled addictions, mental illness and struggled hard to come to terms with her sexuality for her entire life. The life of Dusty Springfield has been chronicled now in a new book. The book is called Dusty, an intimate portrait of a musical legend, and it's written by Karen Bartlett, who joins me now. Karen, welcome to the programme. When you wanted to get the book together, was it because you were a fan of Dusty, or had you heard so much about her that you thought that this person is just too interesting not to write a book about?
I was a fan in the sense that I'd loved her music, and I'd read quite an old book about her and thought that, you know, I really thought that she was due for a sort of a revival and lots of new information about her. And I wanted to know more and to put her in sort of context, really, I suppose, because, you know, she was such a huge figure, and I felt that that book about her hadn't been written yet.
Well, then let's take a look at just how huge a figure she was. And I think it breaks down into two things: the kind of private and pretty terrible 1970s and the absolutely amazing 1960s. I mean, she was a voice of a generation. People say she was ahead of her time. I don't think she was. I think she was that generation. And when the swinging 60s were really swinging, especially in the middle, she was the main female voice.
She was, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I think there's a part in the book where I talk about them writing in the Telegraph about the Ad Lib Club and the Beatles being there and, you know, everyone dancing on the multicoloured floor. And, you know, it was Dusty that they were playing as the soundtrack. And she was the sort of the soundtrack of the 1960s. And the person with, you know, not just her voice, but her look and her hair and her image. And, you know, she was that iconic figure of the 1960s. So in that sense, you know, she did sort of personify the 1960s, even though as a person, I think she was ahead of her time and didn't quite fit into it in the same way that people think that she did.
Yeah, in a funny way, when you say icon of the 60s, like with the peroxide blonde and the bouffant hairstyle and the evening gowns and the heavy makeup, it's kind of a weird thing when you look back and say, because you look at the Mary Quansey, you look at the sort of Paul McCartney's kind of girlfriends and the miniskirts and all that, she was just completely different, and yet she did personify the whole thing. Let's just go back a little bit, though. Like, she was born in London. She had a pretty tough enough upbringing.
She did. I mean, she was born in West Hampstead, and she had a hard time, but I mean, she had quite a middle-class upbringing. And I think one of the things that people who don't know about her, the first thing that strikes you is that when you listen to her voice, you know, she sounds posh. She's not a kind of working-class 1960s singer at all. And she went to a convent school, and she was very well-educated. But it's true that her family life wasn't very happy. Her parents weren't very well suited to each other. She felt that she had a very difficult, unhappy childhood. She certainly felt that she was emotionally abused and neglected, and that her brother was always the favourite. Her mum had a drinking problem, and her father was very musical, but also a very unhappy person. So she did always feel very unhappy about what had happened to her in her childhood.
Okay, like, she was in a band then, or she had formed a band by the late 50s, and then it was the Springfields by the 60s, and they had quite a bit of success. After that, or by 1963 direction, when she kind of wanted to do something else, she brought out a solo single, an immediate overnight success in some ways. Isn't that true?
It was, absolutely. I mean, people forget now how hugely successful the Springfields were. I mean, the Springfields were huge, and it was quite shocking for people that they decided to split up when they did, because, you know, they were one of the biggest bands in the country. But she decided she wanted to go on her own, and she had a very strong sense of the kind of music that she wanted to do. And even though later on she said, you know, I Only Want to Be With You wasn't her favourite song and she didn't want to sing it, I mean, at the time she was very happy about it, and it was definitely a pop song, which was different to the Springfields. You know, she was sort of moving into being a sort of huge pop star rather than the kind of folksy country direction she'd been in before.
Well, let's take a quick listen to it, because one of the things about it is the actual kind of the playing, the Phil Spector kind of sound, completely different than anything the Springfields were. So let's take a listen to this. Here it is, Dusty Springfield, I Only Want to Be With You. Be With You is, of course, the name of the song, and that is Dusty. That's the first kind of Dusty solo single, if you like. And that was, as I say, it wasn't Phil Spector, but it was the Phil Spector kind of sound. And she found something that she really wanted, and she knew what she wanted too. She was very demanding in the studio when she was making records, wasn't she?
She was hugely demanding. And I mean, that Phil Spector sound, I mean, that was very difficult for her to achieve. And one of the things about her that made her quite unpopular in the studio was that she knew what she wanted, but because she wasn't a musician, she didn't know how to tell people what she wanted. So she would go in there, and in those days, it was a very sort of old-fashioned environment. And I think I say the technicians wore white coats like they were in a laboratory.
Mm.
And the musicians, you know, were sort of all much older men, and you know, they just wanted to play the way they knew how to play. And here was this kind of upstart, you know, young girl coming in and telling them that, you know, she wanted a particular sound, and but she didn't know how to tell them what she wanted. And, you know, things were very fraught quite often in her recordings.
OK, but around these times, I'm talking 63 to 66 here. She went, for instance, to South Africa in 64, and she played to segregated, to mixed audiences, and she was kicked out of the country. She was proud of that, wasn't she?
I don't think she was as proud of that as she should have been. I think she was a bit embarrassed about it, to be honest. I mean, I think that she realised that she shouldn't have gone in the first place, that it was, you know, playing to apartheid South Africa was never something that she was going to want to do.
Yeah.
Because she was hugely friends with all of the Motown singers, and, you know, she was very into, you know, equality for people regardless of their race or background. So she went to South Africa, knew that it was a bit of a mistake, thought that she'd got this special clause where she could get out of it and play to mixed audiences, realised quite quickly that that wasn't going to work, and that they were never in a million years going to let her play to mixed audiences, and then had to come back into the middle of this furore. And people were horrible to her about it when she came back. You know, some people were very supportive and thought it was great that she'd taken a stand, but a lot of other singers and performers, you know, thought that it was outrageous that basically she'd blown their chances of being making a lot of money in South Africa, and they were horrible to her about it. And I think she felt that, you know, she'd made a bit of a mess of things rather than that she'd done some huge sort of principled thing.
I mean, like, I mentioned that in the late 50s she had a band, then the Springfields, and then we're talking mid-60s here, and particularly 63 to 66, well, up to 68 maybe as well, Dusty just ruled, and she was the biggest thing. Was Dusty a diva because of the fact that she did things her own way and they worked?
I think it was a combination of things. I mean, Kiki Dee says in the book, doesn't she, that Dusty was the first diva she ever met. And there's a fantastic story that Mike Hirst from the Springfield tells about being in Blackpool. And, you know, she took on this guy who was like the biggest theatre impresario in the country. And they had a huge, huge stand-up fight because she wouldn't move her amplifiers on the stage by 10 centimetres or something. And then she called his wife a cow. And, you know, the whole thing got completely out of hand. And he said to her, you know, you'll never play in my venues again. And she never did. So it was kind of always in her, those diva-like qualities.
Yeah, but like lots of things got completely out of hand, even like when she was like attaining heights that no woman singer had ever done before. I mean, like she was when she was got a Melody Maker Award at one stage, and she was throwing food all over the place and plates all over the place, which literally is what she was doing, which had been done when she was a kid in her, like, you know, growing up as well. She didn't endear herself to a lot of people necessarily, even when she was the biggest thing around, not least then, of course, the 70s, which we'll get to. She was hard work.
She was, but I mean, she was also... she had a great sense of humour as well. And sometimes with those things, it was hard to know, you know, was it her sense of humour that was just getting completely out of control? And she had grown up in this house where people threw food at each other all the time and threw plates at each other. And it wasn't necessarily a temper tantrum. But on the other hand, she did have a terrible temper too. So it was that combination of, you know, was it funny or was it not funny? And some people thought that all her exploits were absolutely hilarious. You know, she, you know, would put an anchovy down somebody's dress, or, you know, hit them with a French loaf or whatever. And that was very funny. But then at other times, when she was working and she hit somebody over the head with her microphone, well, they didn't think that was as funny. So, you know, there were those two sides to her.
OK, well, then let's take a little bit of the sadness of one of the great hits. And You Don't Have to Say You Love Me is the name of the song.
Don't you...
Dusty Springfield. She said herself that there was a sadness in her voice. And your book says the melancholy and the madness. Do you think that comes through now that you've researched her so much and would say, oh, yeah, listening back now, you see a different Dusty?
Absolutely. I mean, she always had that sound in her voice, even when she was very young and really sort of too young to be singing those kind of songs or to have that sadness. I mean, I think, you know, she had that kind of mixed up, confused, melancholy side of her nature. And I think even when she was, you know, very first solo, and they were driving along past a graveyard, and one of the guys said to her, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "Well, because, you know, I'm looking at the graveyard and thinking about all the lives that'll never be." And so she always had that in her personality. But then, of course, her life did get to be very sad.
Indeed,
as she progressed.
I mean, there's one story where she is driving late at night. I mean, it sounds like something out of The Saint in black and white on TV or something. Like, she's driving in Berkeley Square and she hits a woman with her shopping, and she was more concerned about the dent in her car than the fact that the judge fined her a lot of money for saying you shouldn't really be wearing your dark bloody sunglasses late at night either, driving these kind of fast cars. It's a bizarre kind of story. Like, she just didn't seem to care.
She was a funny mixture. I mean, a lot of people, you know, she had a lot of friends right to the end of her life, because she actually was quite a nice person, and she was very sort of sympathetic and really empathised with people. So she had that terribly nice side of her personality too. On the other hand, you know, she was a diva, and she could be, you know, she saw things from her point of view.
Yeah.
And I don't think she was necessarily all that sympathetic to other people. And yes, you run over a lady, an old lady who I think was even a war hero or something, you'd think that she might be more worried about that. But as I say, she sort of brushed it off and said, "Oh, well, you know, why didn't she say she was sorry for the dent that her tins of beans made in my car?"
Yes, right, so, indeed. Okay, well, like, in these mid-60s then, just to stay one last one of this here, she was doing something else too, which was absolutely brilliant, which was she was presenting television programmes and was introducing Britain to a whole slew of fantastic artists from across the water that they might never have got the chance to see, possibly let alone even hear, from the Motown label and that. She really pushed every one of those big names, from Martha and the Vandellas to the Supremes, didn't she?
She did. And I think that was one of the things why she was so successful and so iconic, was she came at that moment as well when sort of pop stardom coincided with television stardom.
Yeah.
And of course, when she went solo, she started off by introducing those first episodes of Ready, Steady, Go. And that was, you know, that was it for her. So she became like the person that everyone watched on Saturday nights, even though she didn't do that for very long. And then, you know, she did the Motown special, and she was the person, you know, she really did, you know, introduce Motown to Britain, and she promoted all of those singers, and particularly Martha and the Vandellas, who she was very close to.
And she
loved
also,
their music.
Yeah, and she also, like, took some, like, she really knew what she was doing when she was picking her songs. So, like, Jerry Goff and Carole King. I'll give you a bit of this here. It's called Going Back. Great version of Going Back. That's Dusty Springfield, and we're talking about her and looking at the book. And just in terms of what she did next was the big one, because people realised how big she was and how good she was. So let's do the right thing, go to Memphis, get the greatest musicians around, and make a great album. And Dusty in Memphis now, of course, is looked upon as being one of the greats, up there with the Stones and the Beatles at the top of any whatever. But at the time, it was a bit of a mess, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, it was a sort of a red line in her career. It, you know, she never achieved those heights again in terms of the music that she produced and the quality of that record. And it was a classic. But it was also, you know, a bit of a disaster for her. It was a commercial flop. It didn't really sell. But I mean, the making of it was so torturous. And, you know, there's this sort of iconic story about her going there and being so overwhelmed by the whole scenario that she couldn't sing. And the way that they recorded there was completely different to the way that she was recording in London. And she was always very insecure about her talent and her performance and what other people thought of her. And, you know, she couldn't do it. She couldn't sing. But as the book also explains, there was another side to that story, which she didn't tell people, which was that, you know, she'd brought somebody in and she was having a bit of a fling with them, and she was drinking quite a lot and fighting. And so there was a lot going on in her personal life as well. So it was that combination of all of her personal problems, which would take over after that point, really, and become bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And the bizarre thing is that even though it's Dusty in Memphis, she did the vocals in New York.
That's right.
Okay, well then let's take a look at this then, part two of Dusty, if you like. She created the Dusty that we know, no question about it. This was almost like, it wasn't the Irish girl who was brought up in London. It wasn't that. It wasn't Mary O'Brien. It was Dusty Springfield. And in many ways, I'm not going to say it was like a Ziggy Stardust for David Bowie, but it was almost a creation. She wasn't this person necessarily. Is it true to say she also destroyed it?
Yes, she did. I mean, she did definitely create it. I mean, she created Dusty Springfield when she was about 16, which seems amazing. You know, very young age. I mean, how do you even know when you're 16 to sort of go out and transform yourself like that and look like that? And she couldn't, you know, she could never leave the house until she'd put on her sort of Dusty Springfield persona.
Yeah.
And then I say that even at her height in the 60s, you know, she would turn up at performances and see her name up there, but feel like it wasn't her, you know, that there were this split personality, that was Dusty and she was Mary. But then, yes, after Memphis, you know, all of her personal problems sort of mounted. She was finding it harder and harder to record. She wasn't getting as good material. And, you know, things sort of started to snowball, really, and really go wrong for her at that point.
When things went wrong, we're talking 1970s, she went to Hollywood for about 11 years or so, and it was never good. It started pretty bad and went downhill. Okay, there was probably some good things about it, I don't know, but like alcoholism and mental illness would be top of the list.
Yes, I think, you know, in the book I explain that actually I think her mental illness was well underway by the mid-60s. You know, she had all these sort of traits of serious bipolar disorder. She was taking drugs that a lot of other people were taking, but with her bipolar disorder, they reacted really, really badly. So she'd already been in mental hospital. She was already self-harming and she was drinking a lot, you know, really from the mid-60s onwards. And then she went to Hollywood and, you know, she didn't have anyone around her that she knew that had been helping her. And she was lost there, really. She didn't know what direction her career should go in. And, you know, that side of her personality and all of those problems just took over at that point.
And her sexuality, it was hard to conceal her sexuality, but she decided to do that in the 1960s. What was her sexuality? Was she a lesbian? Was she bisexual?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, controversy about that. I mean, I'm fairly sure that she was gay. I mean, she never wanted to, not only did she not want to admit it, but she never, ever came to terms with it herself. I mean, she did have, you know, very brief encounters with men, but she never had a boyfriend. You know, she never had a man in her life that she was really emotionally involved with, and she was only ever really emotionally involved with women. So she was gay, but she never, the sad part of the story wasn't just that she couldn't tell people because of her career, but that she was unhappy about it and sort of conflicted about it really until the day she died.
And also the harming herself, as you mentioned, she harmed a lot of others as well. I mean, the relationships that she had with women, they were never really good relationships by the end of the day, were they?
I think some of the people that she met were very supportive towards her, and a lot of people really did love her. There's no doubt about that. But she was drawn to, you know, drama. You know, I mean, I think there's, in the book, we talk about a relationship she had with Julie Felix, who's also a very well-known folk singer. And Julie's, you know, a very sort of sweet, even-natured, lovely woman. And she basically said, you know, look, I was kind of too nice for Dusty. I was too ordinary, too soft. She wanted people who could take control of her. She wanted people who were going to be quite dominant of her. She was drawn to those people, and then all of that played out and it could all end up being quite horrible.
Yeah, as it, like, I mean, some of the stories you have. By the way, we're talking about Dusty, An Intimate Portrait of a Musical Legend is what it's called. We're talking to Karen Bartlett, who wrote the book. And like mad things at 3 and 4 in the morning, her girlfriend at the time, cat's trying to kill me, she called her cat, and like crazy sort of times. I mean, like, she was just harming herself. She was harming everybody else as well. She then had a cheap plastic surgeon fix something on her mouth when she hurt her mouth and all these things. She went to Bellevue, which is a locked psychiatric ward. It wasn't good times in those mid-70s compared to what it had been 10 years before.
It wasn't. I mean, she did have she had a long relationship in the 70s with a woman called Sue Cameron, who talks in the book properly for the first time. And she was a really good influence on Dusty. And she was a very, not just a successful woman herself, but also very calm and stable. But, you know, Dusty always pushed all those people away. I mean, eventually she pushed all of those people away and she only had the sort of the craziness left, really.
Do you think she was one of these people who was addicted to emotional upheaval?
I do. I mean, I think she, you know, part of it was the circumstances. Part of it was her mental illness, definitely. Part of it was the drinking. I mean, most of these things happened when she was drunk. So there were all of those elements, but it was part of her personality as well. And, you know, you can't just say it was because she had bipolar disorder. I mean, you look back at her in the 60s and you think she was a diva, and it was part of her being a great artist too and a great performer. It was all of those things sort of mixed together, really.
Because when you look at the stories of like Billie Holiday or Judy Garland or Janis Joplin or Whitney Houston or Amy Winehouse, you know, the very unhappy lives, addiction that ended prematurely, etc. Now, it wasn't any of her addictions that ended the life too early of Dusty Springfield. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 94 and died 5 years later.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things that does make her different to Amy Winehouse and Billie Holiday and some of those people is that, you know, she didn't die of her mental illness and she didn't die of her addictions, and she did get better. I mean, it was really a struggle for her, and it was more of a struggle because she had bipolar disorder and people didn't know how to treat it. But she did get better, you know. She did go to AA and she struggled to get sober, but she stayed sober. And by the time, you know, she got cancer in 1994, you know, she'd come back to England. She was living quite a calm life. She was living a very sober life. And that's, I think, what makes it seem sort of quite tragic at that point that she got cancer and she died.
She also turned down a couple of songs that made careers for some people, like Killing Me Softly, Roberta Flack. There was a Bond song too, which actually, a Bond song is the kind of thing that would suit and be actually very good for somebody like Dusty, that she turned down as well. She was supposed to sing Don't Go Breaking My Heart, which made it number one on the charts. What happened there? Why wasn't she? Elton John wanted her, didn't he?
Well, all of those songs really came in that time in the mid-70s where she'd just kind of fallen apart, basically. You know, she'd done one album called Cameo, which was a, you know, complete flop, even though she sang on it very well. And after that, you know, her career, she just didn't know where she was going. And people would turn up at her house in LA and offer her these great songs and she would just say no. All of the songs on the Dusty in Memphis album, actually, she'd originally said no to. And then eventually they went back to her and played her the same songs and she said yes to them. So, you know, she was very sort of choosy about what she sang and, you know, she was more likely to say no, she didn't want to do things than to ever, you know, take on projects and do them.
Somebody in the book says she wanted to be straight, a good Catholic and black, and she was basically none of those things. Do you think a lot of it might have come from some sort of Catholic guilt?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, hugely conflicted about her religion. And, I mean, you know, when she was on the road with the Springfields in the early days, you know, wherever she went, she'd look for a church, she'd go to Mass, she'd go to confession. So it was a huge part of her life. And then there's a scene where, you know, she's just gone to Hollywood and she comes back to visit her parents in London with Sue Cameron, who was her partner. And, you know, Sue Cameron wanted to go to Mass and it was Christmas Eve and Dusty was crying and saying, I can't go because I'm such a sinner. The roof of the church will fall on top of me. And so that was very Dusty-like in a way because she was very dramatic. But it kind of emphasises how she felt about her religion too. And she never went back to it when she was ill.
Just to go back to the 60s for a second here, when the 60s were the 60s and when music was the centre of the universe, Dusty was the centre of music.
She was.
So how was she able to sort of sink? So was nobody wanting to get her back? I mean, I know the Pet Shop Boys brought her back and gave her a huge hit single and that. But to be honest, that was like, I don't know, it just wasn't the real deal to me. It wasn't like as though this was the real... Like, I mean, why did people leave her in Laurel Canyon and the bohemian life of Los Angeles? It just didn't seem to be the right place for her at all. Did nobody want to bring her back to London and do things again?
I think that they did, but... I mean, I think part of it was that by the end of the 60s, music was changing as well. Music was changing and she was getting older. And of course, at the same time as her career was progressing, you know, younger people were coming up and new sounds were coming along. And, you know, in the 70s, she sort of experimented with the kind of more singer-songwriter sound.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't write her own songs, but that didn't really work for her for some reason. And on the other hand, she was terribly difficult to work with and record with. I mean, she recorded this... quite a classic, what would have been an absolutely classic album in 1974 that was never released because she couldn't finish it. And, you know, once the kind of the word got out that, you know, record companies, you know, she couldn't finish the work, she couldn't put the albums out, well, then that was kind of poison for her career, really. And then, you know, they went into the whole disco thing and, yeah, you know, she tried a bit of disco and that didn't work for her at all. So music had moved on as well, really.
And then she ended up earning a living miming her old hits in a West Hollywood gay bar.
That was a short period. I mean, that was before she came back to England. And that was really when she was at her lowest in the mid-80s. You know, after the episode, the cutting herself with the cup and being, yeah, in the mental hospital. And she'd make about $500 doing that. But I don't think she did that very much or for very long, really. But that was a low point.
Well, there were people who were very close to her and who were very good to her and who liked her an awful lot. But I mean, by the same token, in general, isn't it fair to say that she really did chase away the people that she loved most?
She did chase people away, but she did have, you know, she had Vicky Wickham, who was her friend and her manager in the end, and, you know, that who stuck by her for 40 years. And she had Pat, who was her secretary here in London, who looked after her. And they were together for about 40 years. And she came back and lived with Pat and her husband when she came back to England. So, you know, she had people who were there for the long haul. But, you know, nobody that she could really build a life with.
Right. Well, I must say, it's the anecdotal stuff. There's so many, like, having a business meeting beside her swimming pool, which is not only full of television sets, but full of furniture as well, and just total madness. It's the little things. Elton John seems to have been around for an awful lot of that. But let's just take the end in the book, The Intimate Portrait of a Musical Legend. We're talking Dusty Springfield here. At the very end, Simon Bell is her friend, and the people who are looking after her are a bunch of Australian nurses who'd never heard of her. And he brings in the DVD and shows what she used to be. Was that a kind of a Sunset Boulevard Norma Desmond kind of moment of, you know, I was a star once? I mean, did she get as much satisfaction out of it, watching it, as she might have thought that the nurses might have got, saying, wow, we've got a star in a bed here?
It's a really poignant moment because, I mean, Simon, I think, says in the book, you know, the look on her face when they're playing that recording of her looking so beautiful and singing so amazingly in the 60s. And the fact that these nurses were sort of sitting there going, wow, you know, we didn't know that this was who you are and you're a star. And I think that meant a lot to her. And even though, you know, she wasn't particularly interested in her legacy, you know, she wasn't really interested in what was going to happen after she died, but she certainly did take quite a lot of interest in, you know, picking out tracks and things for some of the CDs and albums that came out after she died. So, you know, she knew that the legacy of Dusty was going to be bigger than she was as a person.
Yeah, exactly. And her ashes scattered over the cliffs of Moher. Just one last one then. Like, there's been talk in the last bunch of years about a biopic or a movie about her life, etc. And I know that, like, various people have been mentioned. Do you think it will happen? Is it going to happen? Do you know any news about that?
Well, I know that there's going to be the West End musical in London, which Vicky Wickham, her manager, is organising. And I think they're looking at that happening next year sometime. The biopic, I mean, obviously there's several projects that are in development at the moment. I think the difficult thing with Dusty is, you know, she did so much and there was so many different parts of her life. You know, which part of her life do you choose? Which part do you dramatise? You know, is it the 60s when she was a star, or is it the 70s when she was down on her luck? And, you know, who would play Dusty? You know, who could possibly be Dusty and sound like Dusty?
You know what I'm going to say, who could play Dusty? Because, I mean, just in terms of the look and just the way the music affects other music that's around at the moment, like, I mean, Dusty was able to have low... In fact, she was the biggest hitter in 66 when the Beatles were huge. Adele, and Adele has been mentioned.
I don't know if it's a new project that she's been talked about. I mean, she certainly doesn't sing like Dusty or sound like Dusty, although she has the kind of... She has the iconic look as well.
Yeah, but there's a whole feel of what's in the way her music affects the rest of the music that's around that I think is kind of the same as Dusty, but I know what you mean. Okay, well, listen, look, it's a great read, Karen. Dusty was just one of the greats, no question about it, you know. Voice of a generation, although I still say not ahead of her time, exactly right for her time. Dusty, An Intimate Portrait of a Musical Legend is what it's called, and it's out at the moment by Karen Bartlett. Karen, thanks a million for talking to us.
Thanks.